been doing a series of talks for months now on the core teachings of the Buddha. Against the Stream is primarily Noah Levine, at least, who started Against the Stream in L.A., comes from what's called like the Thai forest lineage. And one of his primary teachers is a guy named Ajahn Chah, who's a very honored monastic who passed some time ago. But that really brought down these teachings and brought these teachings to the West, to the United States. And coming with that is an emphasis in Theravada Buddhism on early Buddhist practice, which mostly looks at Buddhism as a practice rather than a structured belief system. And so the sit that we just did together was an active practice, kind of a see for yourself kind of experiential, perceptual process of checking in, of seeing where's the awareness, is it wanting, not wanting, right? All of these things that we can kind of see for ourselves. And so there's an active, there's an emphasis on engaged Buddhism, I would say. And we've been talking about for a few months the practices of mindfulness, the four foundations of mindfulness, sometimes called the four pastures, which I like a whole lot. I like looking at collecting my awareness into different fields or parts of what's happening right now. So there's breath and body awareness. I'm breathing, I have a body, right? That's happening. And I can also collect my awareness into feeling impression. Just the basic, the very primary sense of, is this experience currently pleasant, unpleasant, or neither? And Mikey talked about last week the third pasture, third foundation of mind states, mindfulness of mind. It's a tricky thing because we're using the mind, parts of the mind, to try to liberate us from other parts of the mind, right? Stressful, obsessive habits of mind, right? A lot of these worry cycles that we spin out in, and regret, and resentment. And so it's hard, and then the mind kind of gets a bad rep a little bit in Buddhism. Like it's kind of the stepchild of Buddhism, but we're wanting to look at even what is the mind up to right now. And so in a way we build out of breath and body to start to anchor our attention, ground our attention in the physical sensorium, you could say the sensations of the body. As we do that, we're able to observe and to have more of an objective view of the mind. Tonight we're talking about the fourth foundation, the fourth pasture, which is mindfulness of dhammas, which is a Pali Sanskrit word that is best to not really translate because there's so much confusion around what mindfulness of dhammas is. In one sense, dhammas, dhamma or dharma, as we know in regular Sanskrit, is can be just the Buddha's teaching. Dhamma, dharma, the dharma is the Buddha's teaching. Dhammas or dharma can also mean truth. It can also just kind of mean things. I like kind of looking at it as natural laws. Or I feel like the best definition is categories of phenomena, which basically means frameworks or points of reference to be applied during meditation. So these are actually things that the Buddha was like, we should contemplate these things in meditation. and they're the list of the Dhammas. And they are the five hindrances, the five aggregates. The Buddhists love lists. There are a bunch of different lists. You don't have to know them all. But there's the five hindrances, the five aggregates, the six sense spheres, the seven factors of awakening, and then the four noble truths. Right, those are the Dhammas that we're contemplating. And so you maybe have been coming for a little while and know that the core teaching of the Buddha was called the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. It's pretty standard in almost every different type of Buddhism, at least has some center around the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And so looking at even these, a lot of this stuff as we come week to week, or maybe we're new, or as we read or listen to different podcasts about Buddhism or get interested in Buddhism, we can start to use some of these concepts and some of these ideas to then, in meditation, see if some of these things arise. To direct our attention to some of these frameworks. And the first one is the five hindrances, which I'm going to talk about tonight. I like looking at mindfulness practice as a subtractive rather than an additive process. So it's not that I feel like most of the time that I'm not trying to really add something or do something extra. I feel more or less like I'm practicing letting go, like subtracting away kind of what gets in the way of my ease, of my well-being, of my equanimity of balance. Sometimes one of the discourses the Buddha talks about, like the uncovering of an ancient ruin. So he kind of compares Dharma practice to an archaeological dig site. Coming on through the jungle and you come upon an ancient ruin and it's covered by vines and dirt and you can just see like the tops of the buildings and the structures. And so sometimes you've got to dig with the backhoe and the shovels, and then sometimes, you know, if you're an archaeologist, you have to have these little brushes. And mindfulness, in a way, is a practice of confronting what is available here now, what's here, rather than creating some altered state or trying to leave here, right? Using meditation as a practice to avoid, instead a practice to confront. And so we get a lot of dirt when we practice. We get a lot of things that we come into contact with that aren't so pretty, that aren't so easy to witness, to be with. And it's helpful to have some labels, to have some notes, to have a framework to identify some of these things. So I don't know about you, but for me in particular is I have this tendency sometimes when I'm really struggling or suffering with something to assume that I'm the only one or that I'm doing it wrong, or this doubt comes in really strong. But then when someone says, oh, that's just doubt, that's one of the hindrances, I'm like, oh, damn, I can see that, right? I can recognize that, and normalizes it a little bit. It's helpful. Carl Jung said that one does not become enlightened by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious. The latter procedure, however, is disagreeable and therefore not popular. Right? That's why we don't charge for our classes here, right? It's hard. I mean, you know, and I will speak a little bit to, if you've been coming for a while, we see that it is a hard practice to take on and to commit to. And if we practice, I really have seen in my friendships and people that I know that have a dedicated, have kind of committed to this practice that we go through life. We confront what is full of sorrow and grief and loss and fear. And so I like that, making the darkness conscious rather than imagining figures of light. It's through understanding suffering that we can liberate ourselves from suffering. We have this tendency, even in popular mindfulness, to emphasize the letting go before the letting in. If I don't let in, I can't really let go. Because letting go just comes in, it's just another strategy of, that basically means I don't want. I'm full of fear, I'm full of anxiety, I'm full of stress, I'm going to let this go. Meaning like, I want it to get the hell out of here. I don't want to feel that. I don't want to embody that. So what does, they sometimes call the five hindrances the coverings. The obstructions, the coverings, the layers of dirt that we sometimes deal with. And they are, the first one is, if you come across it, will most likely be called sensual desire. I like to emphasize the quality of craving. Sensual desire or craving. And then there's aversion. And then there's kind of old school, a pair, they come together, sloth and torpor. And then restlessness and worry, also a pair. And doubt, the fifth. Sensual desire can be looked at as, all of these things can be looked at, I feel like, as a spectrum of experience, of what kind of covers, obscures. The Buddha has one discourse talking about the hindrances, and he refers to a bowl of water. And sensual desire being a drop of dye in the water. So it kind of colors the lens of what we're looking into. And this could be lust, right? Wanting after lust. We usually think sexual lust, which also is sensual desire, but lusting after, it doesn't really matter, just the wanting, right? So it could be lust or craving. Once it really takes root, can be obsession. Desire gets kind of coupled in. It's kind of a bad guy a lot of times in Buddhism as well. And I think it's very important that to say that in my experience, desire can be completely wholesome. It's completely skillful, completely useful to have desires and things that I want. But here the focus is on the demanding the satisfaction of desire. Right? It's the desire that demands fulfillment. Right? We have to fulfill it. Mostly centered around the gratification and the danger of pleasure. I think the basic problem is that I think that sensual desire will make me happy. Like on some level, on some very primitive level, I'm kind of wired to believe that the girl, the job, the new car, the next thing is going to do it. Once I get blank, then I'll be happy. And watching to subtler and subtler degrees how this may be in an extreme manifestation would be, I can't be happy until I get the job or the thing, the big life experience. But even on the very most subtle levels of just sitting and having that feeling of wanting, sometimes I have a feeling of wanting without even knowing what I want yet. Right? Standing in line, waiting on, you know, ordering food. It's like I'm just standing there. I'm like, I want some. I don't even know what I want, but I want something. This feeling of like Melvin Connor, he's a neuroscientist, he says that our nervous system is wired to have a mild sense of anxiety and restlessness, best described by the verb I want, spoken with or without an object for the verb. Just a sense of wanting. So looking at these habits in biological terms, there's a theoretical framework called morphic resonance. And it says that habits, so our habits, any habits, are subject to natural selection. The more often they are repeated, the more probable they become. So in nature, the more often that something happens, the more likely it's to happen again. Does that make sense? And the Buddha pointed to this by saying, whatever one thinks and ponders upon will become the inclination of the mind. So wanting begets more wanting. The practice, the response to wanting is to start to notice, to note, and we'll talk about some of these practices later, and to practice some renunciation of this feeling, this practice of not needing anything extra. Being able to catch the wanting and saying, you know, actually I'm good, and practice renouncing having to fulfill everything. I'm a person in recovery and have been for 10 years, and this wanting for sensual desire ruled my entire life as a kid. Like this, what's next? What's next? What's next? The second being aversion, another covering. The Pali word is patiga, which means to strike against. Can be looked at as resistance, anger, ill will, resentment. Even in subtle form, sorrow and grief can have some aversion. The discourse on like hatred, this comes out of probably what Mikey talked about last week of these, they're called the three poisons: greed, hatred, and delusion. Pretty old school terminology as well, but I like this. This kind of comes out of aversion is the is hatred manifested to subtler and greater degrees. And they talk about this as the honey tip dart. Like sometimes when I'm really angry or pissed off or resentful, that it actually feels good at first. It feels justified. You know, and the mind's really tricky like this is because I have conditioned perceptions of things. And so I see something and I know that it's wrong and it happens. And then my whole justified response to that comes online in my mind. Well, they shouldn't have fucking parked in front of my house, and they shouldn't have, you know? Like, it's like automatically, and it feels good. It's like, wow, it gives me a stance, a position against. And liberation or awakening is oftentimes one of the qualities that comes out of awakening, and I'm talking about sudden awakening, so not like some event that's going to happen at some time, but when we are able to wake up to the resistance and the aversion and the resentment, is that we get to live from a state of blamelessness, it's called. that it actually feels good to not have resentment. It actually feels relieving. For me personally, I figured out there's actually a term for it. I was talking to Dave the other day, my teacher, and he said, I have a sense of existential betrayal that I developed from the time when I was an adolescent, this feeling that, like, the universe is just taking a shit on me. This feeling, and for real, it's very visceral and real and wired in, you know, and has been my response to, I can drop something and get mad at gravity, you know? And she laughed because she lives with me and witnesses that.
That's true.
You know, but I can have this sense of, like, that the universe and the world is against me. And to be able to bring some awareness to that and to investigate and be really curious of, like, you know, what is this position? What is this? Aversion can also, this is important to say, I feel like it can find its way really easily into mindfulness practice, into our Dharma practice. As we're noting and observing and labeling and watching as things arise, right? Sometimes the noting has a tinge, it has a quality of like, oh, I know I'm supposed to just be with this, I'm supposed to just see this and be with it, but I hate it. Right? And so we note and we try to label and we try to become aware and bring aversion along with it. If that makes any sense. I feel like it's important to say because, you know, I can be sitting and really practicing a lot of aversion instead of noticing, oh, this is not wanting. It's present. I can feel that. I can know that. The third is sloth and torpor. Sloth is a sluggishness of wakefulness, so just a feeling of being tired, basically. And torpor is a sluggishness of mental factors, so like a dullness of attention, a dullness of self-awareness, of like a not really motivated sense or feeling. And so I like to say it's kind of two things. One, it's the mind that loves to hit the snooze button in the morning, right? This kind of like, later, right? This tired. And then it's also the habit of mind that retreats from challenges instead of confronting. It's avoidance. This can be really interesting to investigate, especially on retreats or if you sit for longer periods of time, to see what's the difference between just being tired and staying with, oh, I'm just tired. And then when does the mind check out, almost dissociate or check out or become tired or withdrawn because there's some emotional experience that it doesn't really want to confront. Sloth and torpor can be a helpful tool for, especially with really difficult, like having trauma triggered, like checking out can be a defense that the body and mind has developed to titrate emotion so we can just experience enough so we don't go into crisis. Sloth and torpor often can also masquerade as self-compassion. Of like, if you're anything like my teenage self, it's like, oh, I deserve a break today, you know? And sometimes it's true, I do, you know, I do need to rest. I do just need a day off. I do need a few hours. but watching that too. Next is restlessness and worry. On the spectrum, there's like agitation, excitement, distraction. The Pali word for restlessness, I believe, is translated as quivering above. So, like, really actually not being embodied. Restless without rest, right? Restlessness and worry can take root a lot of times, very similar to the wanting and the craving can have this sense of like anticipation. Sometimes worry out of guilt or something that we've done that we don't really feel too good about, and then we really worry about the outcome or worry that we might do it again. The mind becomes distracted, distraught. And lastly, this is said to be the most challenging of all the hindrances is doubt. It was the final test of the Buddha during his enlightenment. The hindrances are, if you're a visual learner, I kind of like this, they're personified or demonified or whatever as a demon named Mara that visits the Buddha. And Mara's fifth or last and final test to get the Buddha to move to, he was so close to clearing away this ancient rune, of doing the work and digging and brushing. And Mara came up to him and said, "Why do you deserve this? What makes you so special that you could be, you know, free from this suffering?" And he reaches down and he touches the earth, and the earth bears witness. And he basically, by doing that motion, says, "Because I'm a part of this world. Just being born into this world, I deserve. I deserve the opportunity to free myself from suffering." Doubt is the part of our mind that talks us out of what's good for us. And that usually masquerades as indecision, insecurity, a sense of not that I don't know what's best, that there's no part that's deep down in here that actually can be trusted. And this part of my mind that tells me, why do you think you can do this? Why do you think you can sit up here and teach to other people, right? Why do you think you can say something in this conversation? Or why do you think? And the Buddha's moving into, we're going to talk about some of the ways we can work with these hindrances, is his practice was to say, "I see you, Mara." So he would see this part of his mind and he would identify it and say, "I see you, Mara." Even after the Buddha's awakening, Mara continued to visit the Buddha over and over and over again. And the difference between before his awakening and after is now he saw it for what it was. It's not that the doubt went away, but he recognized the doubt. He recognized the craving, he recognized the aversion, the restlessness, the torpor, and he would just say, "I see you. I know this. This is familiar." So in working with the hindrances, the first really skill that we're developing and we do with mindfulness is what's called introspective awareness. The literal suggestion of practice from the Buddha was, when obsession and craving is present in the mind, one knows obsession and craving is present in the mind. And, more difficult, when obsession and craving is not in the mind, one knows obsession and craving is not in the mind. I look at anger, how many times I say this all the time, do I walk around and say, wow, I'm really not fucking angry right now, right? That thought, but with mindfulness, you know, with practice and with really tuning in, especially as we sit, right? As we sit in meditation, we see the presence and absence. Because if I don't see when obsession and craving leave, I don't get to behold the cessation of suffering that comes along with craving and obsession. It's the third noble truth. We want to behold the end, the ceasing, the passing away of craving. The Buddha said everything is impermanent, even our mind states, even these hindrances are impermanent. We just got to stop doing this and trying to, you know, figure them all out and get, and instead just see them. Oh, I know this. Doubt. Fuck. Doubt. All right. Hang out with doubt for a little while, right? And then see, oh, I feel more, you know, doubt is not in my mind. It can be tricky because we're not looking at the opposite of doubt, so it's not necessarily that I'm confident. It's just that doubt is not here right now. And then we move into looking at the conditions that lead to the arising of the hindrance. So what caused doubt to arise? Knowing the conditions that will lead to its removal, and knowing the conditions that prevent its future arising. An example, you know, we all have a tendency. I'm a social worker, and I like work with a lot of guys in recovery, and I know this tendency when we're lonely to contact ex-lovers, ex-partners. Right? Maybe you know this one yourself. You know, maybe starts with thoughts of low self-esteem. I'm always by myself. Everyone else has a partner and I don't. What's wrong with me? These kind of, you know, we don't even really oftentimes have much awareness around this. It just kind of starts with this and moves into I'm lonely, I want connection. And then the arising of sensual desire, right? The rising to connect, to get attention, to get affection, to get connection, to have sex, whatever it may be. Right? That so what are the conditions that led to that, the arising? It's good to reflect a little bit and be like, oh, where was I at? And then, you know, and then it led to this. And then once the arising comes, sensual desire is present, the introspective awareness of right now, it's in the mind, right? It's available. What will lead to its removal? I call a friend instead, right? And I say, man, I need to hang out with some folks. I don't feel like this is going down a good road. Been here like 10 times before, right? Call a friend and you go out and you hang around other people and you talk and your mind gets into the connection with others, which is really what we wanted to begin with. And then sensual desire is removed and this language or falls away. It's impermanent. Then reflect on what led to its removal. So next time when a triggering event or an event triggers the same response, loneliness, low self-esteem, thoughts of low self-esteem, loneliness, next time when that arises, we can catch it a little quicker. It's like, oh shit, I'm in the early process. Because I don't know if you about you, but when desire, especially sexual desire, gets in, it's frustrating, right? Unless it's fulfilled in some way. It sucks to want something and to have it and to obsess about it, whether it's sex or whether it's food or whether it's whatever. The Buddha talked about using mindfulness to guard the senses. As a guardian of really being like, oh, you know, you're about to head down this road and I'm going to, what's that action? The last thing I want to share are what are called the anti-hindrances. So these are some of the things that actually are in the category of right, wise, or appropriate effort. Mindfulness is really just a practice of objective awareness, non-judgmental, what is it like right now? Like we said, this introspective awareness. Right now, anger is in the mind, right? But it's also nice to have some skills and some tools of how to work with these things. So the awareness helps because it creates this sense of being consumed by the hindrance to moving, to allowing it to just be a part of what's happening instead of all of what's happening. But then with effort, we can bring some response to the stressful emotion, right? To the craving, to the obsession. So for sensual desire, we already talked about guarding the senses with this example, but also body contemplation. In the first foundation of mindfulness, looking at the parts of the body, of sometimes actively looking at the fact that this body gets old, especially around sexual desire, of like looking at like my story about what I think this person's going to be like based on what's arisen in my mind and my body is not the person. The person's actually subject to aging and to illness and all of the things that I am. And it can be helpful to have this perspective if we need to, to kind of be like, you know, because it's from the perspective of like, what's the use of really sitting here and fantasizing right now? Not that it's moral or immoral, don't get me wrong. Completely fine, completely our choice, right? But if we decide, hey, this isn't really going to be useful to sit here and to have sexual fantasies about this person for 5 minutes and then go into work, like, and we want some help, the Buddha said, contemplate the unsatisfactory nature of the body. This person shits, they sweat, they, you know? And it kind of helps distract us a little bit. It kind of helps take the mind off of it. And we can distract in other ways. We can, you know, like in this example, calling friends and looking at the root. What's the connection we really want? For aversion, this irritation, this annoyance, this hatred, this resentment that arises, practicing loving kindness meditation. So actually internally practicing meeting our aversion with some ease. May I be at ease with my pissed off mind right now? I really like this teacher, this Dharma teacher, Pascal Auclair. And he talks about, he calls himself, every part of his experience, my sweet friend. So he's like, oh, anger, my sweet friend. Mm-hmm. He has this really like nice French accent too. So he's like, oh, anger, my sweet friend. Right? I like that I borrow his voice sometimes when I'm really tripping, right? Loving kindness meditation, then obviously actively cultivating loving kindness, you know, in an actual practice at home. Part of what we're trying to do is, like I said earlier, to let in so we can let go. And so what's really tricky with all of these hindrances is like, how do I practice on the removal of hindrances without suppressing and without avoiding? But I will say that in response to aversion, the Buddha said to actually focus the mind on something positive that's also happening. Calls it gladdening the mind or lifting the mind. He said when you're really in a rut and just piss, to lift your mind out of the rut. Right? I like to think of like a tow truck pulling you out of a ditch or something. for sloth and torpor. If meditating, a very common experience, once we get concentrated, concentration and really focusing on the breath, right, breathing in, breathing out, usually what comes next, especially early on, is a huge wave of getting really tired. Because it can kind of be like a trance, can kind of be really seductive. And so we always encourage, I don't think I say this enough really, you're totally welcome to open your eyes, to take a couple short breaths in, to hold your breath for a second if you want, and especially to stand up. You ain't going to fall asleep if you're standing up, right? And not that there's anything wrong with being tired, but if you want to try to get to know what it's like to be tired, to see is it avoidance or is it just sleepiness, it's helpful to open the eyes, to stand up, to practice some of these things. Also, the Buddha talks about staying outdoors is a good way to, if I think about actually when I've been depressed, my tendency is to stay inside and to not want to really do anything and to hit the Netflix queue, right? And so I like that's one of the encouragements, is to get outside, to get your ass out of the house, right? Go do something, especially if it's the kind of torpor of like avoidance, to actually go physically do. Also, moderation of food intake. We eat a whole lot in this country. This is like probably my, around consumption, is probably my worst precept. I got the drug and alcohol thing down. I don't consume drugs now. But the food intake, damn, right? And the encouragement, I think this is really interesting, is to actually, I think that it's said in the discourse, but I know that I've heard Dharma teachers say it, is to try to stop eating 5 bites before you're full. Right? And this, of course, depends. I work in treatment centers and stuff, what our relationship to food is, if we have a nutritionist and we're trying to eat more. But in regard to just feeling tired and dull, to just be aware of how much we're consuming. Restlessness and worry. I really like, it says visiting experienced elders. When I'm worried about something, to actually go to someone that has experience, and they're like, your worries are bullshit, right? Like, I've been there. You're fine. It feels better to do that. I'm the youngest person, and I'm one of like 4 of the youngest people out of 100 people in my training, the community Dharma Leader Training Program that I'm in. And I've actually found it really useful to go to some people that have more experience and be like, tell me your experience so I can maybe like learn from your experience instead of always having to stubbornly learn from my own, right? And that can alleviate worry and restlessness. Breath meditation, kind of progressive relaxation, doing a body scan, softening the body can help with restlessness. Sometimes even just looking at my feet. Actually, one of the best ways to orient, if you have trauma and you dissociate, is with your eyes, to check all 4 corners of the room. Because most of our information is processed through vision. And so it's the most stimulating of our senses. And so to even use the eyes to be like, all right, where the fuck am I right now, right? I'm right here. I'm cool. And lastly, for doubt, one of the encouragements is to have a strong commitment, to kind of have this no matter what attitude of like, no matter what, I'm going to stay the path. No matter what, I'm going to practice. No matter what, I'm going to make it through it. No matter what I have to do, I'm going to stay. I'm not going to abandon myself. I'm not going to abandon what has been true. And then reflecting. The Buddha also encourages to reflect. Be like, okay, I don't feel it right now. I feel really doubtful. I really don't feel secure right now. But imagining a time when I did feel that way. Saying, you know, like, what would that person do in this experience? The last thing I'll share is that for all of these, an anti-hindrance for all 5 is moderation of food intake, which I found to be really interesting. So watching what we consume can help with all of these hindrances. And good friend and suitable conversation. Nothing takes me out of spinning out more than connecting with someone else. And the Buddha encouraged wise association, of surrounding ourselves around other people that are on some type of spiritual path that's in accordance with our own. Right? And so that's plenty. Mostly love to hear some open discussion. Your own experience with the hindrances. So the floor is open. Thank you.